Department of Energy, and I announced the sweeping plan, teaming up with the Department of Defense and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to convert the entire U.S. to renewable energy by 2030, which is entirely feasible, and everybody was thrilled.
And they believed you.
Believe it or not, they believed me. This didn't dissuade them.
Congress, this National Homeland Security Congress is lobbyists, military contractors, and they believed you.
Absolutely.
And they danced with you.
And they danced with me.
In celebration, they danced.
We're going to have to leave it there, Andy Bickelbaum, Mike Banana, and Gets Crazy Boy. We leave it there. That does it for today's show. I'll be speaking tonight at Dartmouth, 5 o'clock at Moore Hall. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Nepal Saramate, Namrit Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Akafani, Masood Rabi, Karen, Dina Gezder, Amy Littlefield, Cassandra Lazar, Messiah Rhodes, Jarena Dura. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
From Henry Ford Community College, it's WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. We're not the same as last week. Oh, that's why it's new, right? And what is the new WHFR Journal? It is local news for Dearborn and the surrounding area and alternative opinions, a wide variety of ideas about how you can make a difference or you might need to make a difference for things that are almost literally right next door. And it's easy, much easier than if you want to change something in the county or the state or the federal government. That's what we always say. My name is Jay Koronek, and I'm happy to be here. Today is May 2nd. First of all, happy May Day yesterday. Some of you may not realize that the rest of the world celebrates May 1st as Labor Day, in effect, International Workers' Day. And for some of you who are really savvy, say, oh, isn't that a communist sort of thing? Yeah, there was an IWW union worldwide that was pretty much set up by the Communist Party. And so International Workers' Day was an outgrowth from that. But all of the economic stories about communism aside, and all your opinions, okay, at least they got one thing right, and it was 1850s when Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, 1850s, actually wrote Communist Manifesto and several other books, Das Kapital and so on, about economics, about the economics of society. And what they got right was the fact that there are economic classes, the rich, the poor, and sometimes, if you're lucky, a middle class within the capitalistic system. But the problem within the capitalistic system is the workers, especially in 1850, have no voice. They have to take the job at the money the employer wants to pay. It doesn't matter if they can live on that or not. I guess having a few pennies for a little bit of food is better than having no money at all. So two of the things that grew out of that we still have today, and I think it's part of the American tradition, one is unions, labor unions. Workers organize to get equity. Yep, equity, which they can never get equity with the owners or the rich. And of course, in America, for the last 30 years, it's gone the other way. The rich have gotten much richer, and the poor have gotten poorer. And the middle class, well, you know, I think we mentioned on this show 2 weeks ago that middle class in America is not the best off worldwide. Canada is number one. Our middle class is, I think, fifth or sixth for the first time ever in this study. because, well, you can only go one of two ways. Maybe you get really smart and develop some new social media app and you can sell it for $1 billion in a couple of years. And so you become part of the 1%, the rich. But more likely, you lose your job, you're laid off, at least, can't pay the mortgage, you lose your house, can't find a new job. So you become part of the poor. And so that's the fact, Jack. And you know, certainly Karl Marx and Frederick Engels got that right. That is the ultimate destiny for capitalism. Unless your government comes in to sort of balance things out and to regulate. And those are nasty words to conservative Republicans and to libertarians. But it's the opinion of yours truly that whatever level of government can do something for you really good, better than you could do it for yourself, then that's appropriate. Okay? And some people say, well, I could always do it better for myself. Well, you can't do health care for yourself. I mean, you might be able to pay private doctors, but you still have to choose which ones, and you got to get to them. And then you got to pay them, of course. I think I said that. So Labor Day worldwide is not a celebration of communism, but it's May 1st, and it's a celebration of workers' right to organize, and even when necessary, to strike, to protest, legally protest, with signs and gatherings, of course, to vote for whatever candidate they feel can give them that equity. Because workers in general don't have any power if they don't have a union. I mean, that's a simple fact. For those that say, oh, I don't want to be part of a union, I don't want to have to pay union dues. Okay, you got no protection. It's like not having any health insurance. How do you like that? Some of you like that. Well, I don't need any. I'm healthy. Yeah. But what happens when all of a sudden you get sick or someone in your family and you have no health insurance? Well, then it's not so good. What happens in your job if your employer decides he doesn't like your looks, the color of your skin, let's say, or your job performance even, or because you tried to form a union? And so you lose the job. Now, a union would say that and would support you with protests, lawsuits, contract renegotiations to get you equity again and fairness. That's what unions are for. And yet union membership has dwindled because employers don't want them. Because they just cause trouble. I want to run this place the way I want to run it. Yeah, unfairly, that's what you want to do without any respect to the people you actually hire. Well, there you go. I didn't say it yet, but once an hour on this show, obviously, when there are opinions expressed, and today it looks like it's just yours truly here. So my opinions are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College, soon to be officially called just Henry Ford College. Okay? But we thank them very much to allow this freedom of speech. And the reason I speak alternative ideas sometimes is to make you think, not to change your mind, not to all of a sudden lockstep agree with me, just, oh, Kornick said it must be right. No. No, I get a lot of things wrong. And you should do more research. If I challenge you and you think, well, maybe what you believe is not quite right, read. I know it hurts. Read books, read magazines, read on the internet credible, verifiably accurate websites. And it's hard to find those unless you really know what you're doing. But if you can't do the additional research to find more opinions and more in-depth expression than my words, then you shouldn't just believe my words. Got that? How many other media people say, don't believe my words alone. I don't know anybody that says that except me. I'm a teacher. I want to prod minds to grow and develop, perhaps in new ways. Sometimes that hurts, but in ways that you decide are appropriate for you once you know all the facts, the many points of view on every issue. So here's a comment talking about wages from Jim Lessenberry. Jack Lessenberry. I wonder if somebody ever called him Jim. Sometimes Jack is the nickname for Jim, isn't it? Well, maybe not. Jack Lessenberry works with Michigan Radio as well as writes a column for the Metro Times. And thanks to their podcast, anyone can listen to his two-minute, three-minute opinions several times a week. I think it's daily that they're posted on the Michigan Radio website. So here's one about minimum wage workers.
Last week at noon, I snuck over to a little restaurant near Detroit's Eastern Market that's seldom very crowded. The place isn't fine dining, but it's quiet, I like their food, and they left me alone for a romantic hour-long interval with coffee and a bunch of term papers on the Telecommunications Act of 1996. My server is usually a woman I'll call Stephanie, who is sweet, efficient, and a trifle careworn. I think she's in her mid-40s. I know she has kids, and she's worked there for 18 years. My bill was about $9, and I left Stephanie $3, which sounds generous. After all, that's more than the 15% to 20% they say you're supposed to tip. But afterwards, I realized what I gave her was outrageously cheap. I know the restaurant, and Stephanie is almost certainly being paid the minimum wage of $2.65 an hour. She had no more than three tables while I was there. My guess is that she made less than $10 or $12 for an hour of constantly standing on her feet, waiting on sometimes surly people, and cleaning up their mess. Nobody, however, seems to give much of a damn about Stephanie and others in the same line of work. There are efforts to raise the minimum wage for people who don't get tips, but they don't seem to be getting anywhere either. Yesterday, Republicans in the U.S. Senate blocked a vote on raising the national minimum to $10.10 an hour. They said it would hurt the economy and stall the fragile recovery. Their arguments were familiar to me because they said the same things in almost the same words in 1938 when Congress established a minimum wage of 25 cents an hour. Despite the predictions, the economy survived. Today, the federal minimum is $7.25 an hour. In Michigan, it's 15 cents higher. When you allow for inflation, that's actually much less than it used to be. Back in 1968, the minimum was almost $11 an hour in today's money, and the unemployment rate was lower than today. Currently, there's also a petition drive to get a proposal on the ballot that would raise Michigan's minimum wage to $10.10, but we don't know yet if organizers will get enough signatures. Polls do tell us most people like the idea. Republicans don't. Though State Senator Rick Jones of Grand Ledge does want to raise the regular minimum wage to $8.15 an hour. He would even give my server Stephanie an increase of 10 cents. Jones said, "This is very good income for somebody typically with just a high school diploma. I wouldn't call less than $17,000 a year a very good income for anybody. But not to worry, they won't even get that." Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville says he's not interested in raising the minimum wage, period. I don't know if the minimum wage will be much of an issue in this year's election campaign. I do know it should be.
That's Jack Lessenberry's opinion from Michigan Radio. What do you think? Yeah, every time the minimum wage is debated, oh, costs are going to go up. Nobody can afford that. But a few people actually can live better lives. And they can maybe spend some money on things, which I thought was the whole purpose of a capitalistic system. You know, get people to spend money, whether it's on food or room and board in general, room, house, motel, whatever. Or some of the extra things in life. Well, they're, you know, at the poverty level, there aren't too many extra things you can afford. But at least you could afford a little more food. And maybe a better place to live. Maybe some bus transportation, if the buses are running on time. But that's about it. So, you know, I don't understand why it shouldn't be a good deal more than even $10.10 an hour. In fact, the city of Seattle, the mayor there proposed that in that city alone, the city council should change the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Now, I believe that's what workers at McDonald's restaurants were asking for. I mean, they had to pick a round number, $10.10. That's silly, even though it's based on some computation of, you know, the increase in inflation and so on from the last time they checked. But what's happened in Seattle, which is a very, you might say, liberal city and pro-growth and so on, is that business people there had said, well, of course, we agree, but we should phase it in, like over 5 years, like an extra dollar or two each year. And, of course, the mayor said, what's the point? These people are starving now, working full-time or just enough to not get benefits, whether it's 30 hours a week or whatever, and they can't survive, even as an individual. They can't afford to live on their own and eat and have shelter, much less any other quality of life. Pay for education to learn more so you can get a better job someday, maybe? No, they don't have money for that. Yep. So good luck to the poor living in Seattle, and good for the mayor of proposing this. Okay, let's take a look at the paper. There's a couple things going on locally here in Dearborn, and we'll give you the highlights for this weekend. Of course, Mother's Day is not this Sunday, but a week from Sunday. But plan ahead. Actually, every day should be Mother's Day and Father's Day, shouldn't it? I've said that for years. There's some other holidays, like Valentine's Day. If you're in love with someone, tell them. And tell them frequently. And be nice to them. How does that sound? Why does it have to be only on April 14th? That's crazy. Just like Mother's Day and Father's Day. Those are crazy days to celebrate. Because, oh, mom gets a day off. One day a year. From doing all the chores and the housework or taking care of the kids. That's crazy. One day off? Doesn't even get weekends off? Or a two-week vacation once a year? No, one day. That's crazy for mom and for dad. So do away with that. But be nice to mom and dad all the time. As much as possible. Yeah. Okay. The big story that everybody's talking about in Dearborn. Oh, my gosh. It's two-inch-high letters in the Press and Guide from Wednesday. Howell's Bar and Grill destroyed in relentless all-night fire. I didn't know a fire could be relentless. I didn't know I had consciousness. They must be watching some sci-fi movies or something on the sci-fi channel. And so it was last Friday night. And they can't quite know how it started. At least they couldn't at the time the story was written. But Howell's Bar and next door, Sophia's Gift Shop, are both total losses due to the collapses of the several-story buildings and extensive fire damage. Also, the barber shop next door also suffered. That's called Village Barbers and Company on Mason Street. And the owner of that did say that on their barbershop's answering machine, which I guess didn't get damaged, he hopes to reopen soon in the same location or one nearby. Mm-hmm. And he said, we will meet up on Facebook. Too bad he can't cut hair on Facebook. That would make it easier, right? And there's a lot of touching stories, including one personal reflection and commentary from Julie Walker Altus-Lieben on the Press and Guide from Wednesday. It's a commentary. It's an article about memories associated with Howell's Bar. One very sad one is, hey, every time someone left the Press and Guide staff or were fired, they would commiserate with them at Howell's Bar. A lot of memories about people losing their jobs and so on. By the way, my sympathies go to Jimmy Lesnaw, who was formerly know, it's his bar and his operation, formerly was Sully's of Detroit, I think was the official name, even though it was in Dearborn. And that was a great place for blues and gathering, too, in those days. But he lost something. I don't know if he has insurance or not. It doesn't say here. But that whole thing about we went there when people got fired or left for better jobs, which there certainly were for a while in journalism. Now, of course, there's almost no jobs left in journalism. You say, well, wait a minute, all these blogs and so on, yeah, most of them pay very little, if anything. Even the people that write commentaries or op-ed editorials, but not the paper's editorial on the editorial page of newspapers like Morris Goodman, paid zero, zilch, nothing. That's not right, is it? That's not right. How many reporters does the Press and Guide have? Oh, it's got three or four part-time people, but no full-time people. I didn't know that until a couple months. I thought at least had one left. Oh, there was three, four, five, six full-time people back in the 90s. And, well, I think I have a commentary on that from Jack Lessenberry. Let me take a look here. Yeah. Let's take a listen to that. Flows right together with what I was saying. How coincidental. Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio.
Put it mildly, journalists are not the most beloved group in society. They never have been. We show up to tell you all sorts of unpleasant truths about life, society, your leaders, and yourselves. Good afternoon. The mayor's a crook, the governor's owned by special interests, your city is broke, and your water polluted. The country is involved in a ridiculous war it isn't winning, your child is getting a lousy education, your roads will cost billions to fix, and your representatives sold out to corporate interests. By the way, your kids are binge drinking, and you are too fat. Have a nice day. It's no wonder why people aren't all that happy when they see us coming. Like any other profession or family, we also have our share of black sheep. Journalists who lie or make things up are very rare, but nobody forgets it when they do. Far more journalists concentrate on the trivial at a time when it's vitally important that we make the significant interesting. That's why we know all about the Kardashians. The Detroit media have given the forced retirement of a basketball general manager more time, space, and attention than the world crisis in Ukraine. But most journalists in this state toil away, working harder than most people for generally small salaries, to bring crucial information to light and tell you what you need to know. Worse, they do so at a time of tremendous upheaval and uncertainty in their own profession. I was reminded of this last night when I went to the Society of Professional Journalists annual award banquet in the Detroit suburb of Troy. This was an especially happy occasion for me because Michigan Radio's own Lindsay Smith won the award as Young Journalist of the Year, beating out two people from far bigger institutions who've been covering business and bankruptcy. She won largely for what I think has been incredible coverage of the deeply flawed charter school company running Muskegon Heights schools. Journalism banquets are not high-frill affairs. Attendees at this one were cautioned to leave the plants on the table because they had to be returned to a store after the event. When I looked around, I was struck by how many people were not there because they'd been laid off by media companies, especially newspapers, who've been devastated by the changing economic realities of the industry. Some award winners weren't there because they work at places whose staffs are so thin they couldn't take the night off to get their awards. Others have jobs so precarious they don't know if they'll be there next year. But they keep on doing what they do. Last night's honorees included Brian Dickerson of the Detroit Free Press, whose in-depth columns on government are often the best in the state, and Jerry Green of the Detroit News, an Ivy League graduate who for 59 years has been our best example of a thinking man sports writer. You may not realize it, but our society, democracy, and freedom depend on the folks who were there last night. I'm glad they let me work with them.
You're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. This is the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek, and thank you for listening. That was very cleverly written and spoken, and that's part of the problem with finding good journalists and finding jobs for good journalists today. I guess that's one reason I love following Jon Stewart's show, The Daily Show on Comedy Central, Monday through Thursdays at 11 p.m. is when they first broadcast it, because he spends a lot of time criticizing the big media channels, Fox News, MSNBC, the 24-hour so-called cable news networks, so-called news, mostly opinions, and because they're constantly getting it wrong. So he just has a 30-minute show. He could have 2, 3, 4 hours doing this every day of the week, because these big so-called 24-hour news stations, networks, get it wrong. They don't check facts, and they're full of opinions, which are usually not fact-checked either. But, oh well. You might check it out if you have basic cable. It's there, Comedy Central, Jon Stewart, The Daily Show. I think there's an app for that. Full episodes right on your smartphone or your computer if you want. And, of course, this show is always available if you want to listen to it other than broadcast time. As soon as the show's done at 2 o'clock every Friday, instantly there's an archive on our website, whfr.fm, and you can listen to it again. Oh, my goodness. Maybe you missed something. Well, the second big story, other than Howell's Bar and Grill being gone, we don't know why, and we don't know what's going to happen to the future of Jimmy Lesnaw, whether or not he can find another bar to start or not. Anyway, is something that sneaked into Sunday, April 27th, Press and Guide. Wayne County Clerk's Office has released the final unofficial listing. Great. It's final, but it's unofficial. Of candidates who have filed to appear on the August 5th primary ballot. It's unofficial because they're still double-checking the numbers. They have to have a minimum number of valid signatures. And, of course, there's an issue with John Conyers, who does represent a part of the city of Dearborn as a representative to the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and has for more than 50 years. No, he hasn't been there as long as John Dingell, but pretty long. It seems that it wasn't that his signatures were invalid, but the people that were circulating the petitions were not residents of whatever it has to be, his district, or Wayne County, or Michigan, or something. And that makes any signatures that they collected invalid, even though the person that signed really is a voter, and that is really their signature, and that is their correct address. Which sounds crazy to me, but, you know, you don't want people to circulate petitions that don't live there, because then rich people could easily get the petition signatures they needed, right? And you don't want the rich to have any unfair advantage. Oh, I'm sorry. Of course they do. And thanks to the Supreme Court, last two major rulings about elections, you know, corporations are people, and they have complete freedom of speech any way they want to do it. And of course, the corollary to that is the other more recent ruling that, hey, you can spend as much money as you want to on as many different elections. There is a limit of, $2.5 million per individual, per district, per county, per state, or whatever. But you can go crazy. You could give $2.5 million to the Democrat, $2.5 million to the Republican, $2.5 million. So, okay. So definitely rich people are mainly the ones that run for office. Rich people are mainly the people that get elected. I mean, I'm generalizing, but it's true. Okay, take political science basic course, and you'll find out that's true. Okay, so do you want rich people running the world? Do they know anything about poor people and the needs of poor or middle-class people? Interesting question. Oh, they say they do, to maybe get a few extra votes from people that don't know them. But do they really? That they're existing in a whole different circle of friends and activities and education than most of the rest of the people. Okay, well, of course, I could talk about the fact, in the primary, it's between Governor Rick Snyder and Democrat Mark Schauer. What does that mean? Who else is on the ballot? Nobody else. So that's just one of those beauty contests, if you will. It's a poll. It's not a vote. But the GOP, the Republicans, and the Democrats get to put their candidates on, even if there's no need, because there's no multiple candidates in their own party. So in November, let's not forget, if you want more choices than just Democrat and Republican, there will magically appear candidates from the Libertarian Party, candidates from the Green Party, and others perhaps. Yeah. Why? Because they're not the same. They don't believe the same things as Republicans and Democrats. There is a difference. Of course, you have to find out what that is. Are they allowed to have be part of the beauty contest in the Michigan primary elections? No, they're not allowed. Because the Dems and Republicans don't want you to find out that other people could be elected in November, and maybe those other people you might prefer if you just knew they existed. That's pathetic. But the people in power want to stay in power. And so they stack the deck in their favor. All right. You knew that, right? So where are there races that you do have to vote on in the primary elections? Let's talk about locally. Okay. The district of John Dingell. Well, there's actually two Democrats on the primary ballot, and you could either vote for Debbie Dingell or Raymond Mullins. And remember, I think in the primary you have to either go Republican or Democrat. And, of course, it is legal in Michigan. If you wanted to vote for the worst Republican candidates, you could do that. If you think, like, if the Democrats only have one candidate and you're a Democrat for that particular race, you could vote for the Republican candidate who's less well-known and probably definitely would lose against your Democratic candidate. So that's the disadvantage of this kind of election in Michigan. It doesn't have to be this way, but the Dems and Republicans said, well, there's not that many people that will vote for the worst candidate in the other party, because then they can never vote for any good candidate in any race on the ballot from their party. So, just saying, Debbie Dingell has, in that primary, she's running against Raymond Mullins from Ypsilanti. She is from Dearborn. Yep. Now, the GOP, are they really the grand old party? I thought they were just called Republicans, but maybe this is their nickname. Anyway, Terry Bowman, Ypsilanti Township. And he's running against Stephen Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S, in Dearborn. So, that's a challenge for Republicans. Who will be the stronger Republican against either Debbie Dingell or Raymond Mullins? If you're in the 12th District, as most people are in Dearborn, maybe all of us are, in fact, then it'll be Bowman or Farkas versus Dingell or Raymond Mullins, and it has to be decided. Now, the 13th District is where John Conyers has been elected from to the U.S. House of Representatives. But he has competition who is hoping that Conyers won't get on the ballot because of the problems I mentioned earlier. Horace Sheffield is his name. He's from Detroit. John Conyers is listed as living in Detroit, too. So if John Conyers doesn't make it on the ballot, and people like Jack Lessenberry think one way or the other he will, of course he could run as a write-in candidate. The current mayor of Detroit. I always forget, is it Mike Duggan or Dugan? Anyway, he was a write-in candidate, but he had a tremendous organization of campaign workers who got the message out to write him in. And there was a lot of coverage in the media constantly. Oh, my gosh, this judge made this ruling and it wasn't fair, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people felt. So it became an issue of the day, and people would talk about it an awful lot. So he got all of that publicity, too, along with his great campaign. So it almost never happens that a person as a write-in candidate will win. But we'll have to wait one step at a time to see if John Conyers is going to be on the ballot. Most people think that the judges, or just the sheer number of votes, will be greater than 1,000, and that's all he needs, and the minimum number, and he'll go there. By the way, Conyers' competition, because of the way the districts are gerrymandered, is Jeff Gorman from Garden City, Republican from Garden City, named Jeff Gorman, all the way out in Garden City. Can you imagine that? What kind of district that is? You can't imagine, because it's gerrymandered. It's crazy quilt up and down streets and crossing contiguous boundaries of land. It doesn't matter to who was in power last time after the last census, which was Republicans at the federal level. They just chopped it up. They had computers do it because they knew where the Republicans lived. They knew they had to have the same number of people in each district, but how can they get more Republicans in each district? Just 51% is all they need, you know. And then they can always, for the next 10 years at least, until there's a new census and maybe a new majority in Congress, to survive. Yep. They could survive 10 years until 2020. But at that time, it's very important that somebody, and they keep talking about an independent committee that would respect contiguous areas. And everybody that lives sort of in that area knows what district they're in. It's not like, oh, the guy across the street is in the other district, and my district goes from here to 50 miles north, 1 mile wide, something like that. Crazy. But that's because they're allowed to do it that way. So that's got to be totally changed. And here's a comment from Jack Lessenberry about Michigan's election system.
Remember back to the nightmare election of 2000 when, for 5 weeks after the voting, we did not know who our next president would be? The culprit, of course, was Florida. You've probably seen those photos of confused poll workers trying to recount the ballots, holding defective punch cards up to the light and squinting to see if the holes were punched through. Well, back then I felt sort of smug. Michigan, I believed, had no real problems as far as elections were concerned. Our state cleaned up a lot of irregularities after problem recounts with a couple close gubernatorial elections in the 1950s. We avoided punch cards after a disastrous experiment in Detroit in 1970. I thought we were clean, efficient, state-of-the-art when it came to voting. Well, turns out I was very wrong. I didn't know how wrong I was till I attended a presentation the other night by an attorney named Sharon Dolente. She's director of something called the Michigan Election Coalition, a loose and shifting alliance of organizations from the ACLU to the NAACP to the Sierra Club, plus many voter and election law projects. With the use of a short and effective PowerPoint presentation, Dolente quickly showed me the error of my thinking. In California, our most populated state, the average time someone had to wait in line to vote in the last presidential election was a mere 5 minutes. But in Michigan, it was more than 20 minutes. In crowded urban areas, especially poor ones, the wait times was sometimes 4 to 5 hours or more. Many working people can't take off from their jobs or leave their kids for that long, even if they wanted to. Does that prevent people from voting? Of course it does. We are, in fact, the sixth worst state in the nation in this regard. There are ways to easily fix this problem. We could open the polls and allow early voting on certain days, as Ohio and many other states do. We could simply say that anyone who wants an absentee ballot can have one, a privilege we severely limit today. The computer technology exists whereby if I were in Escanaba on election day, a clerk could instantly print out a ballot for me that would include all my local races 600 miles away. Most states have modernized their voting registration and or election methods in recent years in some way, but not Michigan. Additionally, Jan Bendor of an allied group, the Michigan Election Reform Alliance, told me our integrity is further threatened by our technology, old machines using unreliable optical scan tabulators. One study of two elections in Allegan County showed mistakes and irregularities large enough to change outcomes in some races. So, Michigan elections badly need reforming. There are few signs of this happening, however. There are those in government with a vested interest in not having more people vote, especially the poor. Additionally, the Michigan Election Coalition seems too decentralized and weak to have much power to push the lawmakers to do the right thing. But things need to change. both in the interest of simple fairness and to prevent something happening to make us a national disgrace.
That's the opinion of Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio. Moving on then with the primary election listings, in the state Senate, this is people going to Lansing to represent us in the Senate in the state. In the 5th District, which is kind of Dearborn Heights, but it's so crazy, it includes Redford and a little bit of Detroit, and oh my gosh. Anyway, State Senate 5th District, there's only one Republican, Jennifer Reinicke. Okay, so she's going to be on the November ballot. Congratulations, Jennifer. The Democrats, however, have Chanel Jackson from Detroit, David Kniezek from Dearborn Heights, who was just elected as House of Representatives to Michigan. And even before that term is up, he's switching now and trying to run for state Senate. So he's an up-and-comer, and we did interview him on the show here a year or so ago before he got his election in Dearborn Heights, succeeded with that election. Nice enough young guy, whether or not you agree with his stands, but he seems like a go-getter somewhat. Well, he's not even worried about term limits because he's already switching to the state Senate race. And then there's David Nathan from Detroit, who's on the Democratic primary ballot for the 5th District. Then there's Carrie O'Connor, probably a female. Can't tell necessarily about the name Carrie. It is spelled C-A-R-R-I-E, so it's probably female. She lives in Redford Township. There's also Thomas Stallworth III from Detroit and a Frank Tomsic from Redford. So the one that gets the most votes, and it could be just out of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I mean, if they split it equally, each of them would get, what is it, about 16%? So, who's got the name recognition? Well, David Kniezek does. So he's going to probably get 17%, and everybody else will get 16% or less. So he'll be the choice for the Democrats. Not of a majority of Democrats in the primary election, but he'll probably be the choice. Because as you learn in basic political science class in college, the person with the known name has a tremendous advantage, even before they start campaigning. And who can afford a campaign of mailings and, I don't know, maybe announcements on cable TV or some other way of going around the community? Well, the big signs, who can afford that? The incumbent or the person who has the bigger name. Yeah, because they have more chance of getting in, so they get more chance of getting money from people who think it will buy them to, or encourage them at least, excuse me for saying buy, to vote the way they want them to once they get elected. Next conflict. This is the big one. 8 people running State House, Michigan State House from 11th District. And this is Dearborn Heights and Garden City. Mostly Inkster also. Well, on the Republican side, there's 2 people, a David Malhalab from Dearborn Heights and a Jim Rhodes, that's R-H-O-A-D-S from Garden City. So Republicans, you've got a choice to make there. Of the Democrats, there's Ned Apigian from Dearborn Heights, a current Dearborn Heights city council person who is on his second term, is it? So he has he has name recognition out there in Dearborn Heights. A Rashid Bedoun from Dearborn Heights. DeArtis Coleman-Richardson from Inkster. A Dorothy Webb Grady from Inkster. Hilliard Hampton from Inkster. Lisa Hicks Clayton, Dearborn Heights. Councilperson, I believe. At least she does a blog, I know. A Julie Plowecki from Dearborn Heights. And last but not least, Patricia Scott in Inkster. So, oh my goodness, 8 of them. If everybody doesn't know anybody, the odds say that you get 12% or better and you're the candidate from the Democratic Party on the ballot. And the two Names that I recognize, of course, are Ned Apigian, who is also, for disclosure's sake, transparency here, a current staff member at WHFR. His show, the Dearborn Heights News and Views, will not be hosted by Ned while he is a candidate. He's officially in the campaign now for the August primary. And so, as station advisor, I made a ruling that no one can be on the staff and or do shows. Well, only our staff can do shows. Doesn't mean I couldn't choose to interview some of these people before August, but it's not that much time. I can't interview everybody, so it can't be really very fair there. So it's either Ned Apigian or Lisa Hicks Clayton that will get the plurality, that is just one vote more than everybody else, the other eight, who will be the Democratic candidate for State House from 11th District, which is Dearborn Heights, Garden City, Inkster, maybe something else. Okay, the other big contest is Wayne County Executive. And the Republicans have a Fred Bolden from Detroit, a John Dalton from Livonia, and a Daniel Wenderlich from Livonia. But the Democrats have 13. So that means the winner only probably has to get about 7 or 8% of the votes. And here they are. Adam Salam Adamski. And we know Mr. Adamski, who added the Salam part to his name. He's running many contests, sometimes as a Republican, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, he got on the ballot. He's technically living in Wayne now. He used to be in Dearborn Heights, but anyway. Phil Kavanaugh, Redford Township. Sidney Dara, Detroit. Warren Evans, Detroit. Robert Ficano, Detroit, who is the current county executive. And you must know that name, right? Lamar Lemons, Detroit. Russell George Levisca from Westland. Kevin McNamara, Belleville. H. Napoleon, that's Benny, that's right, Benny Napoleon. He lives in Romulus these days. Former Detroit police chief, I believe, right? Might have that wrong, but oh well. Maybe he was former sheriff of Wayne County. Is that what I'm thinking? Anyway, Betty Cook Scott from Detroit is also running for Wayne County Executive, along with Sigmund John, oh my goodness, I wish I was Polish, Zisipkowski Jr. He's from Detroit. William Wild from Westland. Christopher Wotowitz, Hamtramck. 13 people. So will Bob Ficano get at least 7%? And be the candidate? Of course he will. With this many people. I mean, you know, politics is strange, but it would almost be worth the campaign money spent under the table to get a lot of people on the ballot. Because if you've got the biggest name, you get the top number of votes. Now, the only two other people that have a name at all, other than Mr. Adamski, who doesn't have a positive connection of his name to any elected post, Phil Kavanaugh. We used to have a Mayor Kavanaugh in Detroit. Old people as old as I am may remember in the 60s. What was his first name? Now, is this Kavanaugh related to the other Kavanaugh? I don't know. I do know that Kevin McNamara is related to the former Wayne County chief executive, who, grandfather? Father? I don't know. But he actually does have, I can tell you, a definite connection with that. Napoleon, by the way, was Detroit police chief and Wayne County sheriff both before he lost the race for Detroit mayor. Thanks to our program director texting me to keep me up to date on that. No, I'm not going to let the rest of you know what my number is. Sorry. But our program director is special. Yes. So he was both. Talk about a police person, huh? And he did. That's right. He lost the race for Detroit mayor to Mr. Duggan. Okay. Thank you, Mark. So 13 people there. Oh, my goodness. So I would say it'd be between, of course, Ficano, Kavanaugh, and McNamara, not on the basis of anything they believe or any issues related to them, but just because they've got the name recognition. Again, basic political science intro class at the college level. You've got a name people recognize, even if you're not the same person, doesn't matter, they're going to vote for you. especially when there's so many names. Oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? It's too bad there's no women running for that. How many women are running for these offices? I think I found that one, that Kerry person. Dorothy Webb Grady. I'm sorry, and Lisa Hicks Clayton. All right. Okay, we had a couple for the state Senate, state House in 11th District. And then the Wayne County Commission, 8th District, which is Dearborn Heights. Gary Warrenchuk is unopposed, by the way, in the 13th District, which is Dearborn. But in the 8th District out there in Dearborn Heights, we have Diane Webb and Shirley Tolliver on the Democratic side going, I was going to say mano a mano, but woman to woman. And the Republican is Jeanette Christie from Dearborn Heights, unopposed. So there you go. Also, on the primary ballot, there's going to be a couple other issues. Now, according, and this is statewide, there's some local things that have to do with, I believe, smart transportation, where you can sort of call up a bus and it'll come and get you. Okay, and that is really a valid service because the basic bus service is so bad. So I hope everybody will consider voting favorably on that. I think that's going to be in the primary in August, Tuesday, August 5th. Circle that date. If you're going to be out of town, make sure you are registered, of course, at least by July 5th. And so if you're going to be out of town, you can do that absentee ballot. But two statewide proposals will appear statewide, so all across the state. One is Public Act 80, and it's called The Purpose of the Referendum is to Approve or Disapprove Public Act 80 of 2014, which allocates the use of tax revenue for various local purposes. So we have no idea. It's some sort of legislative referendum, and it's called Public Act 80, and the purpose is to approve or disapprove Public Act 80, which allocates the use of tax revenue for various local purposes. Well, of course, money spent locally is probably best spent as long as the people who are spending it know what they're doing. There's less waste. Okay, it's collected locally, it's spent locally. I think a lot of people like that in general. But who knows what this is about? That's just what it's going to say on the ballot. It's crazy. You know, how can anybody vote on that? Okay, second one is keep Michigan wolves protected. But what do they mean by protected? You know, it could be very often the title of the proposal is like backwards. The effect of the details, the devil's in the details, is the opposite from what the title of the proposal is. Next one, no taxes for abortion insurance. Purpose, petition proposes to create a new act to require the purchase of health care plan coverage for elective abortion to be exclusively by optional rider for which additional premium has been paid by the purchaser. So it's all the anti-abortion people that want to see this. I thought that was already the situation in Michigan, that you can't use Medicare or Medicaid for abortion insurance anymore, thanks to the state of Michigan. Okay. And some of these have only been submitted that are listed on mi.gov, that is the state of Michigan website, michigan.gov. There's another one that's called Statewide Proposal Petitions Approved as to Form in Preparation for Circulation. Voters for Fair Use of Ballot Referendum. Petition proposes to amend the Michigan Constitution to extend the power of referendum to bills containing money. Ooh, we'll find out what they're thinking about there someday. There's also a committee to ban fracking in Michigan. And so that may be on the ballot. And this is all for, it could be some of these for August 5th or November 4th. Okay, so they don't say when you scan down. This is the state of Michigan. You don't say which election these things are relevant to. But Citizens for Proposed Wildlife Management. Committee to restore Michigan's part-time legislature. Oh, that's a biggie. So that will either be in November or either August or November. Put citizens in charge. Petition proposes to amend the Michigan Constitution to extend the rights of initiative and referendum to local ordinances and state and local laws making appropriations. Whoa, that's a biggie. And then Raise Michigan. Petition proposes to amend the minimum wage law of 1964 to increase the minimum wage. And of course, details will follow, but that's all the state website tells you right now. And again, it's either, and I've heard it both ways, and people say, no, that's not true. It's either the devil's in the details, or it could be the other way around. God is in the details. Once you find out what the details are, oh boy, guess what? You'll be in favor of it. It's your thing, right? You say, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. It's got to pass. So that means God would be in the details, so assuming God's on your side and you're on God's side and so on. All right. I'm not trying to get religious here. I don't think. Oh, my goodness. Well, we're only 5 minutes away from Highway 61, The Best in the Blues with Joanne Korchinska. So we're looking forward to that. And she's on her way into the studio right now. Let's see what other big stories here. Coming up this weekend, two events on the Sunday, May 4th. And you could make both of them. Yes, you could. The Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market is the last two Sundays this month indoors at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center from 11 to 4. So this Sunday, May 4th, and then again Sunday, May 18th. And they're outdoor. Season begins on Friday, May 30th, and goes on through the summer to October at the Bryant Public Library parking lot. But two more times indoors on Sundays at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center, and second from last time is this Sunday, May 4th, from 11 to 4, and last but not least, Sunday, May 18th, indoors also. Coming up also, the Spring Choral Concert from Henry Ford Community College. It'll be Sunday at 7 p.m. So see, you can go to the Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market from 11 to 4 and still have time, even if you go at 4 o'clock or 5 minutes before 4 and spend 5 minutes there, you still have time to leave and come back for the 7 p.m. concert at First United Methodist Church. There is a charge, general admission $10, $7 student seniors. But it's going to be the HFCC Concert Choir. It's going to be the Renaissance Voices, which is their women's ensemble. It's going to be Blue Fusion, which is their vocal jazz ensemble, and Midnight Blue, which is another vocal jazz ensemble. And also a few pieces will be performed by the combined choirs, too. And it's all conducted by G. Kevin Dewey, HFCC vocal music instructor. All very, very exciting. Yes. Let's see. Other things here. Oh, talking about how newspapers get it wrong. The Times-Herald this week, on the front page, says train station completion pushed back 1 year. That's the headline. Well, the story doesn't say that. Who's editing the paper these days? It's always the editors that pick the titles. I know that the wording from the Press and Guide is a little confusing. It was delayed a year from last year. They still expect it, even with some additional little engineering work, to be open by August of this year. So it's not delayed a year from the last time you checked. Yes, it's been delayed a year from last year, but that's been going on for, well, since last year. I read the news, okay? So to put the headline up, it sounds like, oh my gosh, we won't get a train station until 2015. That's why if you read a paper, you can't just read the headlines. You have to read the story. And in this case, I get both papers, thank goodness, and I know which way the story is. I also get email from the city of Dearborn, anybody can, and their public relations people. So totally wrong. The headline is wrong. First of all, they're calling it a train station. Well, that's shorthand, but it's an intermodal station, which means it's not just trains, but it's cars and bicycles and pedestrians. And buses, I think that's it. There's no airplanes are going to land there. Although someday they might have a heliport, a hell of a port. Did I say that? No. So it was a joke. You misheard it. A heliport for helicopters, yes. Great editorial, second week in a row from the Livingston Daily Press in Argus, which is the 100-eyed monster of Greek mythology. And this week it's entitled Study Up on True Quality of Schools. You should study up on what is true quality and what's good about what we have now and how to make improvements. Great story, great article, great editorial that the paper put up front as their own, and it just comes from a sister paper, the Livingston Daily Press and Argus. Free comic book day tomorrow, and locally, you can go anywhere you want to, any comic book store around the area, and they've got free comic books for you and other free things, parties, sometimes snacks and music and so on. Locally in Dearborn, of course, you know, it's Green Brain Comics on Michigan Avenue in the east side of Dearborn. But I can say that not as a commercial, but just because it's free. There's free stuff. Go in and browse. Don't have to buy. You get some free comic books. And it's any level. Say, well, that's just for kids. No, there's adult comic books. Yep. And there's there's all levels. Talk to the knowledgeable people at whatever store you go to, and they can advise you. Is there a comic book for a three-year-old? Yes. Is there a comic book for somebody who's a senior? Yes. And some of them are long. They're not small. They're actually comic book or so-called graphic novels, which means hundreds of pages. But pictures, okay, as well as words. And there's some beautiful artwork in some of them. You can really get into it, and it's just something to explore. And so the first Saturday in May every year is always Comic Book Day. Free Comic Book Day. Check that out. D7 voters, that's over in Dearborn Heights. Or is it Dearborn? I don't know. But if you're in the D7 district, you've got to vote to decide millage renewal. That next Tuesday, May 6th. Yeah, that's a crazy time. I thought they couldn't do these anything in crazy times, only August and November. But if you actually read the story in the Dearborn Press and Guide, it doesn't say, oh, voters have to decide millage renewal. It says business tax renewal on ballot. So if you say, oh, I'm going to vote against it because I don't want my taxes to even be as high as they are. I mean, it's just a renewal, right? But in fact, it's only businesses that are being taxed, and it's only a renewal. The Press and Guide story, at least the headline, got it very, very right. Okay. And finally, in conclusion, Morris Goodman just had an operation. He's the editorial and op-ed writer for the Press and Guide that gets paid nothing. He's a local attorney. But he has an essay this week in Dearborn Heights Press and Guide from this last Wednesday, Awareness of Cancer. And you should be aware of the disease. He has been diagnosed with it, and his operation is to help cure him of it. So we do wish him well. He's been on this show. He's a great editorial voice in this community, especially considering he doesn't get paid. And his last few columns have been about cancer, and he knows it firsthand, unfortunately. And certainly you should read his article and appreciate his insights. They're really good ones. Well, thank you for listening to the new WHFR Journal for this week, and we'll be back again next week.